Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Welcome to Interchange. My name is William Morris, and I'm your host tonight. Today, I'm pleased to have Professor Beth Hatt join us on Interchange. Good afternoon, Beth.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us. Beth is an associate professor in the Department of Teacher Education in the School of Education at the University of Southern Indiana in Evansville. Beth has a background in understanding issues of equity and diversity in education. She studies issues of race, class, and gender in the educational setting, as well as methods of creating culturally responsive teachers. Last week, we had Barbara Cope, a longtime educator from Gary, Indiana, who joined us to share her observations of some of the issues outstanding in Indiana education. And this week is part two of that, and we're glad to have Beth with us. Beth, let's start with the broader topic of social justice in education. Based on your education and research, how would you define social justice in education?
Okay, I typically define it in two ways. The first way is sort of this broad definition of, you know, tackling inequality, ensuring equity and access for all students. And then the second piece is, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about social justice, but for me it's important to frame social justice as a commitment to people rather than just ideas. So really trying to create change for students and families in the local community rather than just talking about it or writing about it.
How is that usually carried out or achieved? You know, I think when we hear, let's talk about inequalities in our school systems, or let's talk about commitment to people, well, of course, that sounds well, and I think people inherently have an idea of what that means, but how is that carried out in a practical way?
Well, I think it depends on the person that you're talking about. For me, as a faculty member, it means that I do a lot of community engagement. I'm a part of local groups that are working for social justice issues in the community, such as access to transportation, affordable housing. And I also work, some of the work I've done is with a local alternative high school, and actually teaching some classes there and working with the teachers and administrators to help them do a better job of working with the students.
The alternative high school that you're speaking about, in what way is it an alternative high school?
Well, the alternative high school, students who are incarcerated immediately upon their release, rather than going back to their home school, will go to the alternative high school. And then also students who have basically been kicked out of other schools are then referred to the alternative high school.
Is that high school funded by the school system where you live, in the county where you live?
Yes.
Other day, we had our state senator on WFHB, Vi Simpson, and Vi Simpson was talking about some schools that are created by school systems to serve sort of special populations, children with special needs, to distinguish these from charter schools. Do you think there's enough of these kind of schools in Indiana, as based on your research?
Do you mean the charter schools, or do you mean the alternative school setting?
The alternative school setting. Thank you.
Well, that's kind of a complicated question. I think my answer would be that I wish that there were fewer of those schools, because usually they're schools, in my opinion, they're often schools that are set up for students who aren't succeeding well in other schools. And rather than their home schools finding a way to work with the students, to make it work for them there, they get pushed out. And so I think often the students who go to the alternative schools do not receive as high quality of an education as that they deserve. And so actually I would say it needs to be the opposite. I wish there were fewer alternative settings for students, because there's even alternative settings for young girls who are who get pregnant in high school, and so I don't think those students need to be pushed out. I think they need to be kept in their homeschools, and those homeschools need to find a way to better educate and work with those kids and families.
Would we call that keeping them in the mainstream?
Yeah, I think that's one way to put it. I don't think good things happen whenever we kick students out of schools or out of classrooms. I think we're not sending typically a very good message for those students.
When you talk about social justice and education and some of the things you have mentioned so far, how do you think Indiana is doing on the whole in that area in terms of addressing social inequalities? You mentioned, for example, there are children who face transportation issues, children who face affordable housing issues. How are we doing in southern Indiana in terms of meeting the needs of those children?
Excuse me. Well, I think the local school district where I'm at, the Evansville-Vanderburg School Corporation, they have taken steps to ensure that students who are homeless are able to stay at their base school, because sometimes when students end up homeless, they end up having to switch schools a lot. And so I think that is one step in a positive direction. But I think Indiana, and it's difficult to separate what's happening in the state of Indiana from what's happening federally in regards to education, but I don't think we're moving in the right direction to address issues of equity and access for students.
What are some of the symptoms of our state that trouble you? When you say that you don't think that we're moving in the right direction, can you give an example of how we're failing to do so?
Sure. Well, one of my big concerns is the way in the state of Indiana we're pushing for a business model approach to education, where notions that competition between schools, that somehow that's going to increase student achievement, or that students are products that we sort of package and ship out. And part of this business model frames teaching as if teachers just sort of dump knowledge into kids' heads, and teaching is so much more complex than that. It's not simply transmission of information. And so anytime we frame learning in that way, I find it very problematic. And also the notions of accountability are very top-down. I think accountability needs to go both ways, and holding the government accountable for funding education in fair and appropriate ways. And decisions that get made about schools, whether it's all in the best interest of students or not, there's accountability currently only goes one direction. And then I also think that there's bigger questions that need to be asked about race and class. When you look at, in the state of Indiana and nationally, the students of color, in particular Black and Latino students, are much more likely to be suspended from school. They're much more likely to be inappropriately placed in special education classes. If you look at high-stakes testing, overwhelmingly the test results reflect more the students' economic resources rather than their actual ability to learn. So there's lots of questions that need to be asked about why we're seeing these patterns and what's being done to address them, and I don't think the right questions are being asked.
Last week in our discussion with Ms. Cope, or Professor Cope from Gary, we pointed out that Indiana, in terms of like quality of public schools, is ranked in the bottom 10 in the country. And as I'm listening to what you're saying about these accountability issues, bigger questions about race and class, treating students as products as opposed to individuals, I'm thinking that those factors play into why Indiana is ranked so low.
Well, it depends on how they're doing the ranking. If they're looking at it from standardized tests, there's different standardized tests that are administered across the country, so you can't really use that. I don't know what the ranking is based on, so it's a little hard to address it.
Have you read any articles, or have you come across any information that shows what Indiana's ranking nationally, the public school systems?
Well, in all honesty, I don't pay that close of attention to the ranking because a lot of times they're based on measures that to me aren't valid assessments of how a state is doing.
Is that standardized testing?
Yes. That could be. I don't think standardized tests are a valid assessment of what's happening in a classroom and what students are learning and understanding.
What's the short
the quality of a school?
I see. What's the shortcoming in your estimation of standardized testing?
Well, you know, standardized tests are okay to get a snapshot of where students are, but other than that, they're not helpful. Often teachers don't get the results back, or they're not given back to them in a way that allows them to adjust their pedagogy or the way they're teaching. Usually multiple choice tests also don't assess critical thinking. They assess basic rote memorization. They don't assess actual student understanding of content. And on top of that, there's so many things that students learn in the course of a day that are valuable that aren't assessed on a test. And we also know that all, you know, not everyone can demonstrate what they know or what they're capable of through a multiple choice test. So there's way too much being put on a test score that's it's not even meant to determine or be an indicator of. Does that help?
Yes, it does help. And in the county where you live, let's say, for example, in Vandenberg County, do they use these standardized test scores to place students?
Well, it depends on what level you're talking about. They might use them at middle school or high school level to sort of figure out what courses students need to take, but typically they're meant to be used to evaluate a school as a whole, how a school as a whole is doing.
Okay. I know one of the areas that you have done some research in is this area of, or this topic of, street smarts versus book smarts. And if it's okay, I'd like to talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
I know that we sort of, just on the surface of that, street smarts versus book smarts, we can sort of surmise what that might be about, kids who are streetwise versus kids who are bookwise. But perhaps you can explain a little bit more about the work you've done in that area.
Okay. Well, so I primarily do anthropology of education, and so one of the areas of interest that I had was looking at the way smartness was socially constructed or framed within school settings, not as a biological ability, but instead like culturally, how do we construct it, how do we perceive it, how do certain kids get framed as smart or not in schools, and how does it influence student achievement and those sorts of things. And so the piece that you're talking about was something I did and sort of looking at smartness as a concept in schools. And what I did is I interviewed youth who were participating in what was called a Youth Build program in the state of Illinois. And Youth Build is a program set up for youth who left school early for various reasons and who are going back to get their GED. And so I taught I co-taught in the program, and then I started interviewing the youth on their perceptions of what it means to be smart. And almost all of the youth made a distinction between what they saw as book smart versus street smart, and most of them did not perceive themselves as book smart. And book smart they associated with grades, standardized test scores, AP classes. They saw it sort of as these artifacts is what I call it, that they associated with book smart. But most of them did not frame book smart as being important for their lives. And for them, they saw the notion of street smarts as being what was important for them because they had to have street smarts to navigate a lot of the problems and issues that were coming up in their lives. And like one of the students gave me this quote that said, well, anybody can become book smart, you just have to read a book, but to be street smart, you have to have been hungry. And so for them, it was about developing street smarts through experience, and that's what, and so in the article, I talk about ways that schools need to value street smarts as much as book smarts get valued.
Is it at all possible for a school to measure street smarts, or how would the a school incorporate street smarts or place a value on it so that it could be incorporated into a curriculum?
Easily. Like, I think you bring students' experiences into the classroom all the time, and you can teach math through pretty well any kind of content. And so street smarts, doing math through street smarts, they would be knowing how to do math in your head, right? And knowing how to give change back, how to make sure you're getting back the correct change. So that would be, you know, using scenarios or taking them in real life situations and learning math that way. Another example would be, like, for many of the youth, knowing legal issues, like whether it was okay for a police officer to search your car or to enter your home, or how to handle it if you feel like you're being harassed by those, or what happens, like, if you get arrested, what you should do. And so you could build a whole curriculum around that, because you can teach, a lot of times you can teach these reading, writing, math, social studies, all of that, through those sorts of issues that are important to students.
In your experiences, have you seen a situation where those concepts have been successfully incorporated into a curriculum? Or do you know of a school where that has been done successfully, like maybe the alternative school in Evansville?
Well, I know the Youth Build program that I worked with in Illinois did. There was a wonderful teacher there who was successful. He might have some youth who came in the fall at second grade reading level, and within 9 months he would have them passing the GED and at a much higher reading level. But the way he worked with them was always connecting the content they were learning back to their lives and what they were interested in. So I have seen it successfully done. I know of some high schools in Chicago that have tried to work on some of these issues that in trying to make schooling very relevant for kids who have a lot of these other structures and issues in their lives.
I know one of the things that you have that you work on in, as an educator, is creating culturally responsive teachers. And it sounds like these teachers that you just identified, the ones in Chicago and another place in Illinois, have obtained some of those skills to be culturally responsive.
Part of culturally responsive pedagogy is recognizing it. Well, there's two forms of pedagogy. There's culturally responsive pedagogy, and then there's what is called assimilationist pedagogy. And assimilationist pedagogy has been shown to actually subtract from the achievement of students.
Mm.
And a person who uses culturally responsive pedagogy recognizes that all students come into the classroom with valuable knowledge themselves, valuable experiences. And so they view teaching as pulling that knowledge out and connecting it back to what you're needing them to connect it to. A person who uses assimilationist pedagogy instead aren't going to, they're going to perceive the students as coming in without knowledge. One key example of that is when students come in speaking English as a second language. A culturally responsive educator is going to see that as a strength of a child, that they're going to be bilingual. They're going to recognize that the student has all this valuable learning and knowledge available through Spanish or another language, where assimilationist teacher is going to think the child doesn't know anything unless they know it in English. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like they're a blank chalkboard.
Where the most effective approach that research has shown is, instead of seeing students as a blank chalkboard, recognizing, you know, seeing teaching as pulling knowledge out of kids rather than dumping knowledge into them.
You're listening to Interchange, and I'm talking with Professor Beth Hatt from the University of Southern Indiana. We'll be back with you in just a minute. Welcome back to Interchange. We're going to get back to our conversation here with Professor Beth Hatt from the University of Southern Indiana, speaking about general ideas of education and the state of education in Indiana today. Beth, I wanted to talk to you about vouchers and charter schools. I know you've been following what's been going on in Indiana in terms of taking monies away from public school systems and the development of charter schools, the development of this idea of vouchers. Can you share your opinion of what's going on with charter schools? I guess I could go ahead and put my opinion into it, but it seems as if Governor Daniels and the government, as it is now, Indiana State government, is moving toward this idea of charter schools.
Yes.
And I would like to know your opinion of that.
Okay. Well, I can offer a couple of things. First is to recognize that the movement towards vouchers and charter schools is following a business model to education, that somehow providing competition is going to improve quality, but I see that as highly problematic. The second thing is, I did some work when I lived in North Carolina, and I was part of a research team that looked at best practices in charter schools in the state of North Carolina. And we saw a couple of things. And I'll just be honest, like there was a lot of charter schools that were used as white flight out of schools. So it pulled a lot of white students out of diverse public schools. But then also there were some schools that, like, for example, there was one school that was for students with exceptionalities, and it was created by a group of parents who felt like the needs of their children were not being met in the local schools. So they created this charter school, which was amazing, and it was very good for the students and for the families, but the problem was that it resegregated students with exceptionalities, which, you know, takes us back 30 years, 40 years, right?
Was that segregation?
Where students with exceptionalities weren't even allowed in school buildings, right? Or even whether they deserved access to an education. So I guess the answer is sort of complex. Like, I've seen charter schools that I think are really amazing schools, but there's also ways that they can create inequality. And here's why. you know, charter schools in the state of Indiana pull money away from local public schools because the money follows the student. So if a student attends a public school, a charter school, that money gets pulled away from local public schools. Also, there's only certain students who can benefit from charter schools. There's a big issue of access because they have to have a parent or a mode of transportation to get there, and most charter schools do not provide that transportation. On top of that, I have seen charter schools that are quick to push students out, especially students with special needs, who they claim that they can't meet the needs of the students, and so the students have to go back to the regular public schools. So what happens is, but charter schools only benefit certain kinds of kids, kids who have at least opportunities for that transportation, and who don't have typically an IEP. And that's not true across the board of charter schools, but I have seen charter schools operate in that way. The other thing is that charter schools in the past didn't have to follow, like they were able to, you know, they weren't unionized, the teachers weren't unionized, so it was another way to break up teacher unions. And then vouchers is an even bigger issue because then you're taking public money to fund private institutions. So I think we have to go back to the question of what is the purpose of public education.
We
need to go back to the notion that a public education is about having a healthy democracy and ensuring equal access and opportunity for all kids. And I don't think charter schools and private schools and vouchers are going to be able to provide that. You said that you weren't going to offer. What's your opinion of them?
Of charter schools? And
yeah.
Well, my take on them, being a person who is not an educator or totally well-versed in this, my opinion of this is that it invites us to the idea of segregation. There's going to be kids who are separated or taken apart from the groups of other kids who... Well, let me go back. Thank you for becoming the interviewer. I can... but let me... I think that when you start to separate people based on have qualities and have not qualities, I think that's what concerns me the most. So you have kids who have transportation and children who don't have transportation. You have kids who have two-parent homes. You have kids who don't have two-parent homes. You have kids who have access to computers and high technology, and you have kids who don't have that. And I think what happens as I look at the school systems is it starts to separate kids based on, even at a more basic level, than all of the other categories that are being used, exceptionality or an intelligence or whatever. It's starting to separate kids based on what advantages they have in life and what advantages they don't have. So you have a separation between the advantaged and the disadvantaged.
Yeah. Whenever, the state justifies vouchers and charter schools to this notion of competition and freedom of choice. The problem is not every child or family has the choice or the option to go to a charter school or go to a private school, even with vouchers. And for me, the question is, you know, there are good charter schools. I don't want to say that there aren't. But the problem is, if what makes a charter school a good school, why aren't we then allowing more of that local control and ownership of schools? Why aren't we giving that back to teachers and to communities? Because to me, that's the advantage of a charter school, is that it's local control over, rather than state control, over the curriculum, the way the school operates. And that, to me, is where we need to go back to. Why are we allowing some schools to do that and not others? That's what I find, another issue I find very problematic.
Governor Daniels, according to things that I have read, would say that if you are a single mother and you have your child in a school that is not performing up to par, and that the governor then would that the state then would be able to give you a voucher, and with that voucher then you could go ahead and put your child into a school where the curriculum is working, where the teachers are more skillful, where the child has a chance to get a better education. I think on a basic level that's Governor Daniels's argument, is that if you're in one school that doesn't work, then here, take this voucher and put your child in a school that does work. And I guess on one level, if you just sort of listen to it without knowing anything or thinking anything, that sounds good. A parent should have a choice. But that choice doesn't work for everybody.
Well, and I think there's some flawed reasoning behind his logic there. Because one, it's assuming that test scores are an accurate representation of how a school is doing. High test scores do not mean a school is a good school, and low test scores does not mean a school is a poor school. Overwhelmingly, it means the kind of teaching that helps students to do well on standardized tests is rote memorization, this banking style of education where students are passive learners. And so it's not actually a good sign if your school has good test scores. And often also it's just directly connected to the income level of the students who attend there. So if they're really wanting to improve quality of education, the answer isn't to use standardized tests as a measure of how well a school is doing, and instead making sure that we're doing things that we know do make a difference, such as providing high-quality early childhood education for students in all communities, having smaller class sizes, doing learning that's engaging, that's tying into students' life experiences, having parent and family and community involvement. Those sorts of things are what we know makes a difference. So why don't we do those things in those schools? Because typically the schools who aren't achieving well are under-resourced already. They're not being provided the funds and resources that are needed. And on top of that, often the teachers and administrators there may not even have a choice in the curriculum that they're being forced to use. So you have to be careful to. So Governor Daniels is making an assumption there that test scores are actually a reflection of how a school is doing. On top of that, private schools, because they're private, can deny access. And then also when students get into those schools, if they have, if they're determined to need special education services, a private school does not have to follow the same standards that a public school would. So there's lots of reasons that logic is just flawed.
So a child could be in a public school that is quote unquote underachieving. His parent receives a voucher, and that parent decides to go to charter school A, or would like for their child to go to charter school A. But charter school A can deny that child access.
A private school. So the vouchers are for private schools. Charter schools are publicly funded, so they're not technically private schools. So yeah, a voucher, but often that voucher can't even cover the whole tuition. So actually the families who will probably benefit the most from those will be middle class families. Because a truly low income family, there's not going to be free and reduced lunch there at the private school. There's not there's going to be the issue of transportation. There may be additional fees that they could have waived at a public school, but they can't at a private school, and then the voucher won't even cover the full tuition. So it does not increase access, and it's an assumption that private school education is better than public school education, which is not necessarily true. So again, like it's just it's not going to increase access.
Last week, Barbara Cope from Gary, she was speaking about some, I guess we might call them urban schools in Gary and in Indianapolis, and she mentioned some in Chicago, where the overall statistics for the school were not good. Yet the school had tremendous educators. The teachers within the school were talented. They had results. They connected with their students. They were culturally responsive. But still, somehow, the schools did not reflect their appropriate test score or whatever other statistics it's measured by.
Yeah, well, a multiple choice test doesn't reflect true understanding often. It's just rote memorization. And it also doesn't allow students to explain their answers. There's not student-generated answers. There's no critical thinking that's a part of it. So those are just some more examples as to why a multiple-choice test is not an appropriate reflection. Plus, here's the other thing, is that it doesn't measure growth. So you might have a lot of growth. So, for example, here in Evansville, there's a school that if you just look at their test scores, you would think, the person who's not, critically analyzing the test scores of the school could say, oh, that's not a good school. But if you were to measure growth, the amount of growth that students achieve is amazing. So my guess is that in those schools, there's amazing growth, and you might have engaged students who are enjoying school, who are learning, who are thinking carefully, critically, who feel cared for in the environment. It's just a test score can't capture that, isn't going to reflect that.
Are there any tests that are used in educational systems which have the characteristics, the positive characteristics that you mentioned? As I'm sitting here thinking about all of the tests that me and other people I know have had to take through the SAT, the LSAT, the GMAT, I mean, all of these mm-hmm. tests, the driver's license test, all of these tests are multiple choice tests. Are there any tests out there that exist that use creative thinking, as you would say, to assess students?
Well, let's just look, for example, at like the driver's test. which do you think is going to be a more appropriate assessment of how good of a driver someone is? Actually having them go out and drive and be assessed on their actual driving, like, having a person go with them, or to take a multiple choice test?
Good example.
Pardon me?
I said that's an excellent example.
Yeah, so the performance assessment, of actually driving is going to be a more accurate representation of what someone is actually, how the quality of driver that they're going to be. So,
So
there's ways that teachers all the time can do portfolios, they can do all kinds of performance assessments that more accurately reflect what students are capable of and have learned. And the other thing with multiple choice tests is often they're not meaningful to students or to teachers. And it's never a good idea to do assessment that's not meaningful to students or teachers. So, for example, some of the students that I've worked with who at the alternative high school, they over time they got so tired of scoring low on the test that it was easier for them to save face and quit trying rather than to try and score low. So they would just make designs in the bubble sheets. Now, the idea that you're going to assess a teacher's quality when you have students who that's how they perceive the test, that's just ridiculous.
That's so discouraging. As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about certain schools. I know that the Harvard, the Yales, the Stanfords. I know that in the law schools and some of the graduate schools that they have, they don't even use grades anymore.
That was true for my graduate program at UNC Chapel Hill. We didn't have grades.
And so,
MIT, when students go there their freshman semester, they are told what their grade would be, but it doesn't count towards their GPA.
And you just wonder, what would it take to apply those kind of principles to local schools in Bloomington or in Evansville or in Gary, Indiana? What would we have to do to take those same concepts and those same practices and apply those at a local level? And we can talk.
Part of it is acknowledging that a multiple choice standardized test can only tell us so much.
Yes.
And that we need other sources of information. And
yes.
And if you ask teachers, teachers can tell you how they know if students are learning, and that often a number can't do that. But the performance that they witness in the classroom and listening to students, that's how they know how students are learning.
Yeah, that's very
good.
And so
I think part of it is, we've got to have the conversations about what is what is the purpose of education? And if it's learning, then how do we really look at what students are learning? And not just learning, but what are they understanding? And how are they making meaning of what they're experiencing in school? And also, the other thing is that, you know, there's so much more that's important to schooling than just knowing what's on that standardized test.
Absolutely. And you know what? We need to take a quick break here. You're listening to Interchange, and I'm talking to Professor Beth Hatt from the University of Southern Indiana. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Support for WFHB comes from Oliver Winery, growing grapes and making wine since 1972. Located 7 miles north of Bloomington on State Road 37, Oliver Winery produces over 30 varieties of wine, and weekend tours are available with tasting daily. Oliver Winery is open Monday through Saturday, 10 to 6, and from 12 to 6 on Sundays, 876-5800, and on the web at oliverwinery.com.
Welcome back to Interchange. My name is William Morris, and I'm your host tonight. And I'm pleased to have with us Dr. Beth Hatt, professor, associate professor of education at the University of Southern Indiana. And we have been talking about charter schools, vouchers, and education in Indiana. Beth, one of the things I was thinking about during the break is that if the money follows the child, if that's the formula for funding schools, and students are leaving the public schools, I mean, we are actually potentially facing the demise, close, and possible destruction of the public school system as we have known it.
Absolutely. And some people would argue that that's the whole purpose of the reforms that we're seeing in the state of Indiana. You know, one of the questions that I've heard someone pose is, okay, so if we're going to use these standardized tests to determine the quality of a school, well, what happens whenever, you know, what would happen if all the schools did well on the tests?
And what would
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and what would happen?
Well, you know, we can only guess, but my guess is that we wouldn't say, look, great job teachers, great job administrators, great job kids and families. Look how well we've done. We finally have hit the mark. Instead, I think what would happen is the argument would be, well, the tests are too easy. And so the problem we run into is that we're setting ourselves up to be in a situation where teachers and schools can never sort of meet the expectations set for them because they'll constantly be raised.
And according to an interview that I think I've mentioned here before with our state senator here in Monroe County, Vi Simpson, she has said that the teachers, of course, in the reform process, teachers' power in the collective bargaining process has been reduced so that their input into class size, into the curriculums that are being taught and other things that have to do with the quality of education are being minimized.
Oh, yeah, and you know, to me,
like there's a disconnect now between the teachers and the actual functioning of the schools.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think there was a disconnect prior to this, but now it's going to be an even larger disconnect because whenever we start looking at educational reform and the people driving the reform, overwhelmingly the people that are being asked for what needs to be done are business leaders. Right. If you just look even at who Mitch Daniels surrounds himself and advising him on education issues, often it's business people. It's not teachers and it's not education professors who are conducting research, you know, looking at best practices in schools. And so the problem is the people making decisions in education are usually the furthest people away from kids in classrooms.
When did this business model of education begin? I have to admit ignorance in this and say I'm not well schooled in this. When did this business model of education begin?
Well, I think it would depend on who you ask. I would say probably in the 1980s. There was a report released, and I'm trying to think when it was, like early 1980s, called A Nation at Risk, that suddenly framed public schools as failing. And then ever since then is where we started to see this movement towards more accountability, high-stakes testing. But the follow-up to that is that there's a book published called The Manufactured Crisis, which basically shows that our schools weren't failing, that it was sort of this manufactured crisis that then was used to justify these school reforms. And the thing that a lot of people don't talk about is it's a business model, right, for reforming education. And on top of that, there's a lot of money being made off of this, off of these reform models. A lot of money being made off of even just the test, who produces the test. Textbook companies who then align their content to state content to then the test. There's a lot of curricula that's being sold that is supposed to guarantee that, even though often that curricula is not research-based, it's being sold. And so there's a lot of money being made off of these reform initiatives with this business model. And it's connected to this notion of privatization. Like in the 1980s, we started to privatize prisons, and that's where we started to see this notion that we needed to fund typically things we saw as public goods less. And so that's where we see this idea. Now we're seeing all these reform initiatives and the low test scores are being used to supposedly justify why we shouldn't be funding public schools.
It sounds like the manufactured crisis, the book that you quoted, reported a false negative. And based on that false negative, this evaluation of the state of our schools, then now we're pursuing something that wasn't necessary to begin with.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you ask, you know, families, overwhelmingly they will say that they are happy with their local public school. But then if you ask them in general how they think public schools are doing, they say they're doing terrible. So even though they think their own school is doing okay, because of the media and all this rhetoric around high-stakes testing, now people tend to believe that public schools are failing when they're not. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't things to be done and issues of equity to be addressed, but overwhelmingly there are many public schools who are doing a great job.
I know another example of this privatization of schools are, you know, are schools, universities like the University of Phoenix. I think this Western Governors University, I'm not quite sure, that Governor Daniels applauds on commercials on TV. Do those also fit into the same model that you're talking about?
Absolutely. Because this for-profit model has now moved into higher ed. And even so, some of the reform initiatives under Governor Daniels are in higher ed have been connected to this business model, because he's been pushing for 3-year degree programs. And has changed the funding formula for higher ed. And on top of that, there's been huge changes in teacher education as well.
What changes have those been? What are those?
In teacher education, basically there's been a cap placed on the number of credit hours that a teacher education program can be, like the number of hours required, and there's more of an emphasis on content. It's framing teaching as if it's just transmission of information and not all of the other issues that go into teaching, and that are just as important as knowing how to read, write.
So it's the very same. It's the very same. The very same shortcomings that you would see on a multiple choice test given to kids in a high school.
Absolutely.
Beth, one of the things we were talking about last week with Dr. Cope from Gary is we were talking about that when we talk about this resegregation of students based on voucher system and charter schools, there's a resegregation. I guess some people would say that there's a resegregation based on race, based on nationality, based on linguistic background, maybe even religion. But Dr. Cope last week, an African-American woman, was saying that if we look back to the time of Dr. King and the end of his life, what she sees is a resegregation based on poverty. Especially in Indiana, she sees a lot of that. Do you agree with that observation?
Well, I think there's ways that race and poverty aren't always connected, but they do tie in together. But I would say that, you know, if you look at schools, a lot of people don't know the legislation that occurred in the 1970s in particular that started to undo school desegregation, and that left many urban districts such as Chicago, Indianapolis, they never really desegregated in many ways because the court exempted them, urban districts, from desegregating with suburban districts, and there had already been so much white flight that often they didn't have to desegregate completely. And so actually schools now are in many ways almost resegregated. Students today are more likely to be attending segregated schools and are poorer than they were, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So in that sense, there's ways that public schools are failing, but not in the way that gets talked about in the media. Because now the move, okay, so let me give you an example. So now the move is, whenever schools aren't achieving, rather than redistricting so that schools are truly desegregated in a district, like, for example, in EVSC, the schools are very racially segregated. Well, the solution becomes, well, let's just, let's focus on test scores. Let's change the curriculum. Let's do this. Let's do that. Instead of simply desegregating the schools. Because often, just simply by desegregating the schools, you're going to shift resources and you're going to improve achievement.
It's very interesting that these test scores are used to create new systems, new school systems. But within the new schools, within the charter schools, which within these quote-unquote improved schools, they probably don't use multiple choice tests to assess their students anymore.
Well, in charter schools have to take the same state standardized test, but the research does not suggest that charter schools actually lead to improved test scores overall. Nationally, they don't.
I wonder why.
Well, because I don't think the charter schools, I think we're asking the wrong question.
Okay.
We're wanting to see how are students learning, how are they understanding the material, but also bigger questions about, are they doing things that are meaningful? Are we developing good character in students? Are they finding things that they're successful at school, whether it's academics or athletics or art or music? Those sorts of things are very important. And whenever we're solely emphasizing test scores, we're not looking at all those other factors. So I guess we're kind of, it does, you know, test scores don't mean whether a school, you know, don't, are not a valid assessment of whether a school is a good school.
During the interview with Senator Vi Simpson, she pointed out that most of the public school systems in the state of Indiana have suffered great losses in terms of extracurricular activities, musical programs, athletic programs, theater programs. And Barbara Cope last week told us that in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s in Indiana, some of the best education systems relied on those extracurricular programs to, you know, create very good schools. And In Bloomington, I know you went to IU for undergrad. In Bloomington, there was a referendum to refund some of those programs so that they wouldn't go out of existence. But Senator Simpson was fearful that in areas where there wasn't that kind of community support, where there wasn't those kind of funds to supplement those kind of systems, that those school systems would just lose the advantage of having those kind of activities.
Absolutely. You know, some of what we're seeing here in Evansville is that schools where their populations are declining, where either students are electing to go to other schools with higher test scores or charter schools, or there's just a decrease in population, you know, the schools are losing their funding. And so usually the first programs to go are art, music, PE. And the thing is, this goes against educational research. It goes against even just common sense of what we know is best for children. You know, in my own research, looking at why students leave school early or drop out, extracurriculars play a huge role because, you know, the bottom line is you want students to feel like a school is a place they can feel good about themselves and that it offers them something that's meaningful and interesting to them. And for some students, that's not, you know, math, reading, or science. But what is interesting to them and engaging to them and what gives them that feeling that school is a place they belong and something they're good at are things like athletics, music, art, theater, programs like that. And when you start cutting those programs, then you're at the same time going to decrease student engagement, student interest, And you're also limiting just the development of the whole child.
Right, right, yes. Beth, I hate to say this, we are out of time, but I am so grateful for you for coming on to Interchange. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Have a good evening.
Okay, thanks. You too.
On another note, last week, Gil Scott-Heron passed away from complications related to AIDS. He was 62 years old. Scott-Heron was an American poet, a musician, and a spoken word performer. And while he was reluctant and embarrassed by the title, some called him the godfather of rap. But like most labels, this one failed to capture Scott-Heron's vision and his depth as an artist. And it failed to capture his impact on others. I first listened to Scott-Heron in 1974 when I was introduced to his album Winter in America. This album hit a chord with me. Scott-Heron spoke about protest. He described culture. He defined issues. And he did it with a funky hip beat. It was impossible not to listen to Gil Scott-Heron. It was impossible not to hear his words. Perhaps his most famous, most quoted, his highest visibility song was "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." But he did dozens of other beautiful and powerful protest songs. He wrote other beautiful and powerful poems. Some might say he was Dylan-esque or James Baldwin-esque, but really he was totally Heron Scott-esque. Here's a short piece called "Small Talk at 125th and Lennox," a song, a poem, a rap that shows us some of the best of Gil Scott-Heron. Rest in peace, brother.
This is just like listening to a conversation being held by the many people who congregate on one of the most popular blocks in the largest area of Black America. Did you ever eat cornbread and black-eyed peas or watermelon and mustard greens? Get high as you can on Saturday night. Go to church on Sunday to set things right. Listen. I seen Miss Blake after Willie yesterday. She'd have killed anybody who'd have gotten her way. Hey, look, I got a TV for a pound on the head, and Jimmy Jean got the best Panamanian red. Nah, I ain't got on no underclothes, but the hawk got to get through this gypsy rose. I think Clay got his very good points. You say a tray bag with 13 joints? Who cares if LBJ is in town? Up with Stokely and H-Rap Brown. Well, I don't know if the riots is wrong, but Whitey been kicking my ass for too long. I supposed to, baby, but they held my pay. Did you hear what the number was yesterday? Junkies is all right when they ain't broke. They leaves you alone when they high on dope. Damn, but I wish I could get up and move. Shut up, hell, you know that ain't true.
You've been listening to Interchange. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris. The executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music by Jameel Effiam. Stay tuned for Stardust with Brother Tillman, coming right up next on your community radio station, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.